lost some people to the Great British Bake Off. Which I hasten to add I've never seen, but I presume it's about baking. Anyway. So congratulations for not being lured away by the Great British Bake Off. Somebody was saying, oh yes, but I can watch you on YouTube afterwards. I thought you could watch the Great British Bake Off on YouTube as well. Anyway, some of you will have been here from the start of the seminar. Some of you won't. Some of you might be the first night of the seminar tonight. So I want to recap a little bit of what I've said. And then I'll say a little bit more about meditation, and then we'll finish again with a meditation, like we usually do. And we'll be finished by 9:45. Okay, so... how did I want to start? I can't remember. So what we've been focusing on in this seminar is imagining in a new kind of consciousness. In a way, that's where the whole seminar, for me, keeps coming back to and arising out of, is this issue of imagining a new kind of consciousness. And I keep on using the story of a child's consciousness and how you can't tell a child that your consciousness is different. You can't explain to a child that you have a different perception. I won't tell all their stories again. But if you try and tell a child, no, I see things differently, they can't understand it. A child can't understand that their consciousness can arise in a new way. They think their consciousness is it. Just as you think your consciousness, as you experience it now, is it. I often can't imagine that consciousness can arise in a different way, even in a quite different way. I mean, it's quite interesting when you think back on childhood. When you try and think back on childhood, you can't really remember it. You sort of remember it from this consciousness. You can't really re-inhabit that consciousness. Like I notice when I have very early memories, I don't know whether you notice this, but you don't remember from the point of view of the actual child. So I don't have memories that are from my eye level. Often I see myself in the memory. Do you notice this? So one of my earliest memories is my mother stirring a Christmas cake. I've got a very large family, so I've got three older brothers and younger sister. My mother stirring a Christmas cake and me reaching up onto the counter to look at her doing that. But I remember it from above my mother, looking down on her stirring the cake and me looking up at her. I don't remember it, you know, I don't remember the bit of bowl on my mother's arm. I remember it from above. We can't even remember what that consciousness quite is like. Even when we think we can, it's a construction, really. Often childhood is a kind of blank that we fill with all kinds of stories, sometimes quite frightening stories. Anyway, be that as it may, as a child you can't imagine another kind of consciousness. And we're still in that position. We have an adult consciousness, or at least we aspire to an adult consciousness. Sometimes we don't, frankly, even manage that. The other day I was eating chocolate in my room, thinking you're behaving like a child. Anyway, I'm sure you don't do that. So sometimes we can't even manage an adult consciousness. Adult consciousness is probably rarer than we expect. And sometimes we can be humiliated by the fact that we haven't really got a sustained and sustainable adult consciousness, never mind anything higher than that. But what you're doing when you sit down to meditate, what I'm doing, having been meditating for 30 years or whatever it is I'm sitting down to meditate to foster, to discover, to reveal to myself a higher kind of consciousness, a greater consciousness, that's more than the consciousness I've sat down with, as it were, more than my ordinary self. Yeah. So we all, though, have intimations of this, of the consciousness. All of us do. So earlier on in the seminar, I was using the example of Wordsworth. And talking about this story from the Prelude, from the two-part prelude. Wordsworth had this incredible experience as a child of nature being conscious, of living inside a larger consciousness. He said it was so strong, there's a lovely letter he wrote to someone, I can't remember who now, it was so strong, this sense of nature being alive and conscious, that one time on the way to school he had to cling to a wall and feel the solidity of the wall to remind himself that he was separate from nature. So sometimes children do have a sense of a greater consciousness. Interestingly, it's often the animistic sense. And it's important that it's that in the Wordsworth. In other words, this sense of nature being alive, alive in the same way that you are. So with my little niece, Alex, when she was three, I lifted her up into the tree and told her that the horse chestnut trees are dying. You know, they've got this blight, haven't they? There's more horse chestnuts dying. So it's like Dutch elm disease all over again. And I lifted her up and showed her the damaged leaves and the small conkers. And I said, look, the tree's very ill. And all the trees are very ill. And as we left the tree, she said, bye-bye, tree. I hope you get better soon. Yeah. And that's because your child consciousness naturally relates to the world as being conscious like you. This is probably why Wordsworth is so preoccupied with childhood. It's because he experienced the natural world as being conscious like him, but in a much greater, more mysterious way. He talks in terms of unknown modes of being, which I really like, that he talks of, he talks about a dim and undetermined sense of unknown modes of beings. So sometimes you experience this as a child, don't you? Unknown modes of being. Sometimes you don't, but sometimes you do, especially through nature. And then I was saying that sometimes you experience this new kind of consciousness in trauma. Sometimes, even like when a parent dies, or even in terrible things, you're touched by a different kind of consciousness, a sort of that feels like almost like a sort of grace. Yeah. But then I was thinking of a more mundane example, which is sometimes when you're playing sport. This isn't an example I can bring from my own experience, but you know, some sports men and women talk about being in the zone, don't they? That they enter a new consciousness in which the game, the player, and you know, everything becomes one, or rather not one, but a new kind of consciousness arises. So if you're playing tennis, you have this new capacity to respond. It's a new responsiveness, primarily. And you respond with greater accuracy and skill and exactitude and grace than your normal consciousness could do. I don't know whether you've ever experienced it. Sometimes you experience it just very slightly, that you're playing with, as I say, this new accuracy and grace. And often you're stronger, actually physically stronger in this consciousness. So you move more easily. I remember once when I was young, I was learning how to do the crawl, swimming. And you know, if you try too hard, you kind of sink. If you don't try hard enough, you sink. But at one time I remember swimming outside and this new consciousness arising. And you see how clumsy this word consciousness is, because it suggests a new kind of thinking. Whereas I mean a wholly new state of being, which includes your body. That's why, as I say, we've been doing yoga and more body-based things here, because it's not just a new mindset, it's a new being, it's a new body, really. And I remember swimming with this new power and grace. So suddenly, it's a lovely experience, you suddenly move through the water. You don't quite, and it doesn't feel like you're making any effort. You are making an effort, but it doesn't feel like an effort anymore. Do you see what I mean? And you feel more graceful, more powerful, but less strained. Yeah? So these all are actually intimations of unknown modes of being, as Wordsworth would say, rather grandly. But do you see what I mean? That experience of swimming, playing tennis sometimes, they suggest that there are unknown modes of being in which the normal distinctions between me and what I'm doing, even me and the world around me, the water I'm swimming through, the ball I'm hitting, starts to change. The usual categories of life, which is me in here and world out there, starts to change. Yeah? So yes, you can experience it through nature, you can experience it as a child, you can experience it through trauma, you can experience it for no particular reason. Just the other day I experienced it just looking into the dark tunnel of the tube, waiting for a tube train. And just for a second, this dark tunnel of the tube looking down into the darkness seemed to mean something. And I just caught it. This unknown mode of being, just slightly, ever so subtly lifting. And then I looked down the other end of the platform and suddenly everything seemed meaningful, but I couldn't say meaning what. That's the problem of the word meaning. You think, well, what does it mean? But suddenly, something else more important was going on than I realised. And then, of course, as soon as I thought, ooh, then it disappeared. As soon as you go, ooh, I like this, then it goes. You know. So as soon as you're playing the game and you're thinking, wow, I'm doing really well, there it goes. As soon as you think, oh, I'm in the zone when I'm swimming, it goes. As soon as you're realise that you're enraptured by nature, you lose it. Yeah. As soon as self-consciousness comes in, it barges these unknown modes of being away. Yeah. But meditation, do you see, I don't know whether I'm connecting all this for you, but meditation is the royal road to discovering unknown modes of being. I like this unknown modes of being because I like the unknown. Higher is problematic, deeper is problematic. Actually, you don't know. And the Buddha figure here represents those unknown modes of being constantly flourishing. It's a shame in a way, it's a static figure, but the figure actually represents constantly opening out into new unknown modes of being. So even the poem I read earlier, I don't know whether you got anything, if you know Wallace Stevens, you know, when you read them, you think, that's gorgeous. I've got no idea what he's talking about. The houses are haunted by white nightgowns. None are green. Or purple with green rings. Or green with yellow rings. Or yellow with blue rings. None of them are strange. With socks of lace. With bearded centaurs. People are not going to dream of baboons and periwinkles. Only here and there, an old sailor, drunk and asleep in his boots, catches tigers in red weather. Isn't that fantastic? Catches tigers in red weather. What on earth does that mean? But catches tigers in red weather. What on earth is red weather? And a sailor asleep in his boots. An old sailor drunk and asleep in his boots. Catches tigers in red weather. The houses are haunted by white nightgowns. So I imagine what he's saying is the houses are haunted by ordinariness, by conventional moral assumptions, by our day-to-day habitual consciousness. None of them are green or purple with green rings or yellow with blue rings. You know, he really makes the thing that they're not there. And then he says, people are not going to dream of baboons and periwinkles. In other words, even our dreams very often don't give us access to a new consciousness. Sometimes they do, but occasionally this old sailor drunk and asleep in his boots catches tigers in red weather. And what you're trying to, I think what Stevens is trying to do there is just by those words conjure up a new kind of consciousness in which you can catch tigers in red weather. So that's what we're trying to do when you sit down to meditate. That is effectively, folks, here's the crux of the whole seminar, that is the whole meaning and purpose of life, is to discover unknown modes of being and to align your life in such a way in which that can happen more and more. One of the reasons why we talk about going on retreat so much is because I bet you in those conditions, it's those conditions that allow you to discover unknown modes of being. It's interestingly in those conditions that you're more likely to dream of catching tigers in red weather. Often it's on retreat that you have dreams that seem to go beyond your normal dream life, that talk of unknown modes of being. Yeah? So what we're trying to do then in meditation is foster, discover, make a certain kind of effort in which, from which, new unknown modes of being can flourish. So the primary symptom of unknown modes of being is when the distinction between you and world begins to thin, begins to become attenuated. That's the main thing, isn't it? So if you're ever with very small children, there's a point in their life where sort of consciousness hasn't yet risen into their eyes, and their eyes are just like buckets in which the whole of life just pours in, and they look around you to look at the pigeons on the floor, and they're not even staring. They're just absorbing life. Like you can see it pouring into their eyes. Yeah? Why did I say that? Anyway, never mind. I've completely lost myself. Where was I? Were you listening?
Bucket eyes,
yeah, but where was I before that?
Dreams.
Who?
Dreams before.
Oh, dreams, that's right, yeah. Yes, thinning. That's right. Ah, I've got there. Don't worry, folks, I'm in charge. just about. So do you see that the main symptom is this thinning between my perception of myself and my experience of the world, the attenuation of that. And do you see how in any meaningful experience you have, when you say something it's meaningful, that's what you really mean. So when I say that experience of swimming was meaningful, that's what I mean. Me and water, movement, consciousness and body, all were moving in a different, more unified, more graceful, more powerful kind of way. When I look at a landscape and it suddenly becomes meaningful, the distance between me and the world has thinned. The barrier I put between myself and the world has thinned. When I communicate with you deeply, with either together just now or individually, when we have experienced a thing called communication, it's because the barrier between me and you has thinned. Yeah? When I even read a novel and really, really get absorbed in it, do you see what you mean by being absorbed? Is that the barrier between you and the imaginative experience that you're reading about has thinned. So that's what we're always trying to do. How do we find a way in which me in here and you out there, the wall that we create between those two things thins? How does that happen? What we know happens is that every time we're in a bad mood, a negative state of mind, a coarse or self-referential state of mind, and that can include being very up and intoxicated, We thicken the wall, don't we, between myself and other people. As soon as I feel unhappy, as soon as I feel arrogant, as soon as I feel hypercritical, the wall between myself and the world is thickened. As soon as I give to you, as soon as you give to me, as soon as you really try to listen to someone, as soon as you try to watch your breath, that thickening of the wall that we create between me and the world starts to thin. The more it does that, the more new kind of consciousness arises, these unknown modes of being, and they're unknown because they transcend the distinction between me and world. And they can transcend that distinction to such a degree that it feels fully mystical. So one of the images that I love from Christianity is the image of the Annunciation, the image of the Annunciation, where the angel comes to tell the Virgin Mary that she's going to give birth to the Christ child. Now, I don't believe any of the theology. It's all, for me, a highly poetic image, as if it was an image written by Wallace Stevens, one of those really weird ones. Tigers, red weathers, virgins, angels. Kind of similar, yeah? It's a metaphor. But in that metaphor, a new consciousness has arisen to such a degree that it feels like the angel breaking into the house of your ordinary being. It feels like another consciousness. It's so unknown to you that in that unknown, you can only consign it to other. Do you see what I mean? And this is what we usually consign to religion. If you've got a Christian worldview, you can only consign it to others. I've had experiences where it really does feel like the angel, highly inverted commas, something, a kind of consciousness, larger than my own, more beautiful than my own, like the angel, more powerful than my own, like the angel, more loving than my own, like the angel, breaks into my ordinary consciousness. In the moments I've experienced that, which is not as much as I'd like, I feel transfigured. Yeah? But I know that it's not literally something coming from outside. I know, because of my Buddhist practice, that it's unknown modes of being arising to such a degree that I can't recognise it, and I consign it to the box of other. Yeah? This is why, when people have these experiences, it's not the experience itself that's problematic. Often it is the experience. It is an experience, a genuine experience of unknown modes of being, to use Wordsworth's words. It's how you categorise it afterwards, what you call it. If you think it was being touched by the hand of God, you'll get into all sorts of problems. If you just think it's because, I don't know, just a sort of weird chemical reaction into your brain, you'll get all sorts of problems. Yeah? So consciousness can arise in new ways. Just as your adult consciousness is a new consciousness compared to a child's, so your consciousness can keep doing that. That's what being adult really means. It's fostering a new level of consciousness all the time that goes beyond me and world, that thins the distinction between self and world. It can come in very, very subtly, as when an artist starts to feel that the painting is painting itself. It can come in very abruptly, as in the image of the Annunciation. It can be startling, even deeply unsettling, or it can be hardly noticeable, a sort of atmosphere that just very subtly changes your perception. Yeah? However it comes in, that's what's... When we experience it, we have things like, this is what my life is meant to be about. This is what life is for. This at last is satisfying, truly satisfying. This is valuable, this is meaningful. All those rather clumsy words. Yeah? So what I've mainly wanted to say is that these unknown modes of being are always characterised by a thinning of the division between self and world. And what I've wanted to say as well on this seminar is that meditation is the kind of royal road to discovering that consciousness. So what I've been emphasising and what we've been emphasising is firstly, this sounds sort of counterintuitive, is that you really, first of all, you sit down, you close your eyes, you notice how much of your experience is locked up in your mind, in your thoughts. Mind isn't a very good word, but just in your thoughts. The Buddhist word for it is prapuncha, which means mental proliferation, even mental fabrication. You're just going over stuff in your mind, like the stuff, that rubbish in the mind. So first of all, we're noticing that in meditation, and we're stepping out of that into direct sensations of the body. That's always the first thing to do. Step out of this clumsy, noisy, clattering mind into the direct sensations of the body. And then what I've been suggesting is that we really try to feel the discomfort in the body. Because it's often the discomfort in our body that makes us just go off in our mind, daydreaming, wall-gathering, fantasizing, planning, remembering, arguing, and so on. Yeah? So see if in meditation you can learn gradually to just settle into discomfort, actually relax into it. It's not so bad. If you try and make it go away, you make it worse. In fact, you know how to make your discomfort worse by trying to wish it away. If you don't believe me, try it next time. Yeah? As soon as you think, I wish it wasn't like this, you just make it worse. Yeah? So then we've been saying that, so first of all, you just settle into your body more and more in any meditation. Try to allow yourself to feel discomfort if there is any in the body, and there very often is some. Relax into it, soften into it. And then look to see whether you can calm the body and the mind. So what we've been emphasizing is looking for calm and looking for pleasure. So one thing you might do is, you know, you're doing the mindfulness of breathing. Think of an image, perhaps, and we'll do this in a minute. Think of an image where that makes you feel calm. So sometimes I imagine that I'm doing this practice sitting at night by the sea in a particular place that I associate with my childhood. And I just, the sound of the sea, you know, when it's dark and it just laps slightly. And in my mind, the lapping of the sea is like my breath, or the breath somehow is the lapping of the sea. And I just see if I can settle into this darkness of, you know, you're sitting on the sand's really cool, and I'm sitting on the side of the, and the water's lapping, the waves are just folding over, and that's my breath. And I just see if I can settle into that more and more and more. So sometimes you can use an image to cultivate calm in the breath. Do you see what I mean? Or you can just say, calming the body, calming the mind, calming the breath. But see if you can consciously look for calm. But when I say look, in a kind of playful, easy-peasy way, not in a kind of, right then, calm, you know, calm down. It won't work. And then see if you can notice any pleasure in your experience. As soon as you start to calm down a bit, your experience feels more pleasurable. Yeah. And really see if you can directly get into pleasure. So that might be, as you calm down, your body feels more pleasurable. See if you can breathe with that pleasure. Or it might even be that you get distracted and you think of something which gives you pleasure. So I often told this story, but often on retreat, particularly on solitary retreats, I get this period where I think about films a lot. I just keep, you know, I play funny films and, you know, I play the bits through again. And I play them because I want pleasure. My mind wants pleasure. So sometimes what I do, if I notice it, I can drop beneath the playing the story in my head into the pleasure that I associate with that film. And then I just breathe with that pleasant sensation. It's not the pleasure that's problematic. It's a narrative. It's a fantasy that we just get lost in, yeah? So even if your mind goes off, see if you notice, if your mind's gone to something pleasurable, think, ooh, let me just experience that pleasure. The actual direct feeling of pleasure, which is not a mental fantasy, yeah? And try and then enjoy that pleasure as a direct feeling in your body. So, you know, say if you're going to meet your, after the class, you're worrying that I'm talking a bit of a long time because you're going to meet your beloved after the class, and you've got this pleasurable feeling about meeting them. Well, you just sort of drop into this pleasurable feeling and then see if you can just breathe with that. Let go of the images and just breathe with the pleasure. So slightly look in the meditation for pleasure. If you look too hard, the pleasure will go away. Yeah. So it's like you just slightly keep a bit of an eye out for it and just keep calming and calming. Yeah, calming the breath, calming the body, calming the mind. And then what I want to suggest we do tonight is you try to stabilise yourself around the breath, around feeling the breath, and then see if you can get closer and closer to the breath. So, I don't know whether you've noticed this yet, but when you watch the breath in meditation, very often, quite crudely, there's you and there's breath. So again, there's this wall between you. This time it's weird because it's between you and your physical experience. So you're kind of watching your breath like a Dalek from this eye on your head. You know, you're like you are meditating Daleks for a while. That was a joke, but never mind. I don't seem to be in that sort of mood tonight. So see if you can get closer and closer to the direct sensations of breathing. So what you'll find, for instance, is that you easily talking about your breath, breathing in, breathing out. Even the word breath, there's no such thing as breath, that's just a word. You never experience breath. You've got a particular breath at a particular moment that only you have. So see if you can get right up close to what do I actually feel when I breathe. And also you'll notice that you're subtly predicting the breath, subtly controlling it physically. So breathing in, breathing out. You're actually slightly doing it. See if you can let go of that as well. So what I'm suggesting is you let go more and more into the direct experience. And you see that to do that, we're trying to step across this divide between me and my breath, me and my experience. So often that's what we live in, isn't it? A kind of conflict even between me and my experience. If I get closer and closer to my breath, eventually me and my experience just disappears and there's just this new unknown mode of consciousness, which is my experience, but it's not mine and it's not experience anymore because they're just abstract universal concepts. You're just trying to get, what do I actually feel now and now and now and now? But there's no such thing as now, that's just an abstract universal concept. What's actually going on? What's going on is change, isn't it? That's all that's ever going on is change at every level. Can you feel changingness? Can you feel get closer and closer so that all there is changingness? Yeah. The more you can do that, new modes of consciousness will arise because you'll be stepping beyond this barrier that you've placed, that I've placed, that we've all placed between myself and my experience. If you can do that, when you open your eyes at the end of the meditation, the world will seem different. Okay, so let's...